want to thank everybody that's read, and I want to introduce the speaker. My story is part of his story, and he'll tell you that part. But if it wasn't for Ferris, I wouldn't have got here. Having said that, I'll tell you the rest of the story after he finishes, in case he leaves anything out.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ferris Johnson. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Hey, Ferris.
And actually, I'm sober today by the grace of God and by the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and by powers beyond my control. And I'm grateful for that. And I endorse that message. I can't say I'm real happy to be here because I am not a public speaker. And I don't like standing up in front of a bunch of people talking. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pretend you are all naked. Put your clothes back on. Put your clothes on, George. Ridgeview has a special place in my heart. George does. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Actually, my story is more like what it was like, what happened, what it was like then, what happened, and what it's like now, and then what I hope it's going to be in the future. So I guess that's pretty much how it's going to go. I was born in Athens, Georgia, which is not too far from here, and I was born in August of 1952. So for you math majors, that makes me 60 years old. And even though I don't like being 60 years old, it beats being dead. So, you know, I guess I just have to take that. But, you know, in all honesty, I can't say I'm overly happy about anything like being 60 or having back pain or arthritis or any of that crap. I'm not real happy about it, and it makes me restless and irritable and discontent. But, you know, whenever I get that way, I actually have to say, well, I'm not dead. And so it makes me a little bit grateful, and I can only do that by the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the lessons I've learned, by the people I've seen endure stuff that may in fact be worse than mine, and yet they can take it with a smile. So I really owe this program a lot, and what I owe it most is the ability to change my attitude at any given moment. When my attitude sucks, I can make it stop. You know, I can tell God, grab me around the throat, straighten me out, and turn me back in the right direction. I am cursed with a great memory of my own life. I don't remember names and faces worth a darn, but I'll tell you, I can remember my life in great detail. And I can remember as a little boy, I always felt like I was out of place. I felt like I was unloved and unwanted, and that was just crap. You know, as I look back, I had the best family ever. Now, I was born in this big family. Actually, I only have one brother. But I have all these relatives and cousins. And, you know, I got cousins. You can't even count how far off. And yet they come up and they say, cousin, and they grab you and they hug you. And they've been doing that for years. It's not because of anything other than that's just the kind of family I have. They're a bunch of loving people. But I never felt like I belonged. Never. Even as a little kid. I felt irritable, and I felt like, you know, they were always picking on me, and I was always scared. I can remember the first day of nursery school, and some of you young folks don't know what nursery school is. They have other names for it now, but I went to nursery school, and I actually had a cousin. He and I were a lot alike. He was 2 months younger than me, and we started nursery school together, and we dropped out. You know, I'm not kidding. We dropped out. And I'm pretty sure it was because we were scared, and we would go in the front door, and then we'd tiptoe out the back door, and then we'd go back up the street to our grandmother's house and sit on the back porch and eat our lunches. And I remember that real clearly because it was the first time I learned the art of deception. And I learned how to deceive people and go where I wanted to go and do what I wanted to do. I actually then went to kindergarten, and I actually graduated from kindergarten. But I was scared to death. I was so scared that I was so different. And I was always looking for the differences, and I was looking for somebody to kind of, you know, say that I was different and I was worthless. And, you know, so then first grade, then second grade, then third grade. Well, you know, I get to fourth grade, and I decided I was going to smoke some cigarettes. My mother was had some ladies she'd play cards with periodically. Well, one left some cigarettes at our house. So I went home from school. I had just gotten a key to the house, fourth grade. I could actually let myself in. So I said I was going to smoke me a cigarette because I was a big man. So I sit on the sofa, light a cigarette. I'm going to thump it like the big folks do. Ash fell off, burned a hole in the sofa. So it was a green sofa, kind of one of these really odd color green sofas of the 1960s. So, and plastic, so it burned a hole right down to that cotton stuff they used to put in there. So I get some green crayon and I try to color the thing. And it's right up on the arm. And so I was going to color it so my parents wouldn't notice. Well, you know, my parents get home and my daddy sees the hole in the sofa. So he says, what happened? I said, well, I was striking matches because I was a little notorious for striking matches. You know, as you might gather pretty soon, I'm actually kind of crazy. But so my dad said, no, I smell smoke. You've been smoking. Oh, no. Yes, you have. Well, you know, any person by that point said, yeah, busted. No, daddy. Let me smell your breath. So I'm going to blow it out to him and through my nose. You know. And you may think I'm kidding. You know, I actually must have thought my parents were fools or something. And but, you know, of course, he takes me back. He whips my ass. That's pretty much it for the cigarette smoking for that time. Anyway, I get to middle school, and I'm still different. But actually, on the Sunday of the first Super Bowl, by the way, my parents took me to church very often, me and my brother both. Sunday school, church, BTU, Bible school, revival, you name it. Church doors open, there we were. I hated it. And so Sunday of the first Super Bowl, though, they had a program that afternoon at church. I told my dad, no, I want to stay home and watch the Super Bowl. He said, fine. I knew he had a bottle of liquor down under the kitchen, under the cabinet in the kitchen. So I said, you know, I'm watching the Super Bowl. I ought to have me a drink. I mean... You have to understand that in my mind, I was an adult. Maybe I was 13, but I was an adult. So I fixed myself a drink, and I drank it, and I fixed myself another drink, and I drank it, and another drink, and I drank it. And before you know it, you know, I was actually pretty loaded, enough to throw up. But I went through this period of time where I finally felt good. I finally felt like I belonged. I felt wanted. So... I threw up, I ate some peppermint, I added some water back to his liquor, you know, I put it away, and that was that. But I managed to find little bottles like Dristan and others that I could take a little liquor to school. I was in high school by that time, and I would take a little liquor, put it in my locker, I would drink it, then I could be a big boy, I could talk to the girls, I could dance, I could do all kinds of things. And I felt really normal. And so through high school, that's pretty much what I did. I had a girlfriend who actually became my first wife many years later. And she would tell me, there's something wrong with you. And so I ignored that because, I mean, I was cool. Anyway, I graduated from high school. You must understand that I lived a double life. I was an A student, honor student. Teachers thought I was just God's gift to students. And then there was the other me. You know, the person who wanted to be the bad boy, wanted to hang out with the bad folks, do what the bad folks do. And my parents made me mad because they wanted me to be at home at a decent time. And I would think about slipping out of the house. But they had these screens that were hard to get off, you know. And I knew I better not go out the front door. And I was scared to go out through this window. You know, so I was stuck. But fortunately, by the grace of God, I went to college. Actually, I got to go to college a summer early before college started. And at that point, I determined that I should be able to buy liquor myself. Now, understand, I was 16. I turned 17 a couple months later. But I was here in Atlanta, and we had these ID cards. So what we did was we cut them open, took the card out, typed some fake birth dates on the back, took it to this local store, and the guy let us buy liquor, you know. Started off with some liquor, some wine that tasted more like fruit juice, but we had to step it up a little bit. So before you know it, I had actually bought myself 2 bottles of liquor. I got drunk. I had a blackout. I messed with people. I did all kinds of crazy stuff. I got sick. And I said to myself, I'll never do this again. And so I didn't do it again for 2 more nights. And, you know, and that's kind of the story of my life. I did more crazy stuff than really should be. I shouldn't be here today. I should really be dead. And I have enough near-death experiences, or maybe they were really death, and maybe I just came back. I don't know. Maybe I'm a vampire. But, you know, the bottom line is I did not know when to stop. Enough was never enough. You know, if I felt somewhat good, then there obviously I could feel better. And I never could quite get back to that first drunk. So I get to college, and I find out I'd already heard about this stuff called reefer in Athens, you know. But see, it was just coming to the University of Georgia. I didn't know anybody at the University of Georgia. So I get to college here, and I said, I'm going to find myself some of that reefer. So I found myself some of that reefer, and the stuff didn't do a thing. It didn't do a thing. But perseverance wins out. So, you know, about the fifth time, it really did something. I said, hey, I am here again. Happy days are here again. So I proceeded to reefer and, you know, this, that, and the other. I actually, once again, stellar student, got to do research at the University of Michigan after my sophomore year. So this kind of got around to the first of my near-death experiences. I go into a lab and they got this big bottle, I mean a huge bottle of some powder. Well, I didn't know a lot about the powder, but I knew about that C on there with, you know. I said, now that's got to mean something good. So I get me some of that powder, and I get some beer, and I try to mix it all together. And for those of you who don't know it, it was actually called barbitol, and it does not mix with beer. It does not. However, if you shake it around enough, you'll get yourself some clumpy shit that you can swallow. So... And after you drink enough of that, it's pretty unlikely you're going to wake up for a while. Now, I also was fortunate enough to have found myself a girlfriend by then, and we had moved into one dorm room together. So when I lapsed into unconsciousness, she took good care of me for 3 days until I woke up. She really did. I'm not kidding you. It was 3 days. I woke up. I said, man, that was really bad. That was really bad. I shouldn't do that again. I finished that summer. The professors up at Michigan thought I was really great, wonderful guy. Come back to school, go back to school. During that year, I started using a little heroin. Not much, just a little bit. Recreational heroin. Because I had a cousin in Detroit, and he would come down, and we'd use a little recreational heroin. Nothing heavy, though. But the next summer, I went to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Research, big bottle, C, barbitol, beer, 3 days. Again, 2 summers in a row. You know, that is technically what's called an overdose. And that's technically what's called you need to be in the ICU. But when you got people who will take care of you, I tell you, if nothing else, if you're going to kill yourself accidentally, you got to have some friends first. Make sure you got some friends. And they will take care of you, and they won't let you die. And even though they have no medical training, they just won't let you die. So, you know, that summer comes to an end. I come back to Atlanta. I finish college. End of my senior year, I'm out of there. I got all my hours. I'm done. What I tell everybody is I want to save my parents some money, so I'm going to come home. Well, hell, that ain't the truth. I was tired of school. I wanted to party. So, interestingly enough, I had already been accepted to medical school, and I know that scares the hell out of some of you. It should. I'm accepted to medical school, and I decide that I need to have a job, so I get 3 jobs. And I spend most of the money financing the 9-month party preceding medical school. I actually get with my old high school girlfriend, and we start hanging out. And then I have the great idea, we need to live together. We need to move to Pittsburgh and live together. Well, interestingly enough, even though I'm not so sure I ever thought she had many morals, she said, I can't do that. I said to myself, why not? All we're going to do is live together. I mean, heck, she says, I can't leave Athens, Georgia, in sight of your parents. Are you kidding? So I said, well, okay. Turned out that my dad was pretty much tired of me coming home anytime I wanted to, so he announced to me I could either pay rent or leave. So I said to myself, screw that. I'll leave. So I packed my stuff, got married, and 2 days later showed up at a family reunion. Now, mind you, all of this happened within 3 days. My dad tells me to pack my stuff, I move out, I get married, and show up at a family reunion in Louisville, Kentucky, with all of this extended family, all these people who love me. And so they said, married? Where was the wedding? where was the invitation? I thought it was just fine. What I found, I have learned an important lesson from that. You can actually use enough stuff so that you forget everything that matters. I don't care if you've been to Sunday school and church and BTU and Bible school and revival. I don't care. You can actually dissolve all of your morals in chemicals. They will just actually melt away. So I had melted all of mine. But I said, all right, we get married. We go to Pittsburgh. And, I really feel sorry for my ex-wife. Number one, I was very resentful. Turned out I had simply married a mother again. Because she told me what time she wanted me to be home, what I needed to do. She didn't want to make love with liquor on my breast, stuff like that. Well, it makes me pretty upset, a little bit, because actually, after all, I'm a man. I'm entitled. Well, I'm going to actually cut to the chase. She actually tolerated it. So here I am now, a fourth-year medical student, and I'm doing pretty much the same thing except worse. And on one particular occasion, it turns out my wife discovered I was having an affair. Well, I was already getting a little tired of being wasted all the time, so I cut a deal with God. I said, God, look. So she actually calls my daddy long distance from Pittsburgh and tells him what a real, piece of work I am. And so my daddy gets on the phone. He said, now, we did not raise you that way. And, of course, Daddy, you're right. And he was right, but I really just wanted to get off the phone. But I then made a deal with God. I said, God, if you just won't let her leave me, I will not drink. And guess what? She did not leave me. And guess what? I did not drink. I discovered marijuana maintenance. And so, proving to myself that I did not have a problem, I graduated from medical school and went into the United States Air Force to do my internship and residency, where I would step out on the back dock of the hospital and indulge in a little marijuana maintenance. And I thought that was just fine. And I had more affairs because my wife broke the deal. She broke the deal. She went out and had an affair herself. And I said, God, that is just awful cruel of you. Because we made a deal. And since you broke the deal, I'm going to drink some more. So by the time I finished my internship, my residency, I'm back to drinking again aplenty. We go to Montgomery, Alabama. I continue to drink. I continue to drug. By the time it's about two years there, we have our first child. Now, pregnancy was always a great experience for me because it gave me a legitimate reason not to drink, because you understand I had taught my wife how to also drink and use drugs so that we could participate together. And she would stop while she was pregnant, and so I could stop while she was pregnant. And then she would have a baby, and then we would start again. And it was always very disappointing, but we went through that cycle twice. And yet I thought maybe I was still a decent father. So we went through that cycle a couple times. And it started getting a little warm in the Air Force, by the way. Because, by that time, I'm actually in charge of a clinic and stuff. I won't even tell you what it is. But it had a little prestige because I'm still the man of the double life. Great guy by day, terrible guy by night. So as there were some people who were in Korea at that time, and the word had gotten out that they were using drugs and handling drugs and whatnot, and somebody mentioned my name. And so here all the way back in Montgomery, Alabama, the commander says, Farris Johnson, I just know you're not involved with anything like that. And I said, no, sir, I am not. You're exactly right. And I reasoned, though, that that was not going to hold for too long. And plus, I wasn't digging the authority in the Air Force after 8 years. So I decided it's probably time to go home. So we get out, and I was going to stay in Montgomery. My wife says, let's go home. I said, we never get along at home. She said, well, either we'll make it or we won't. She was right. We did not make it. We moved back home with our two boys, and life got worse. I worked in an emergency room. I'd go in a blackout for the most part. Everybody thought I was the best doctor in the world. Seriously, I'm not kidding you. I do not know how that happened. However, I will pause to tell you this. God has these wonderful eyes, and he looks out over the horizon of time, and he sees where he wants you there. So he decides, maybe I won't drop him off after all. That's the only explanation. I should have been dropped off. I should have been dropped off, but I was not. But I'll tell you, 4 years after ER, get tired of that, going to private practice, working like a dog, find a great source of cocaine, start putting vodka in the refrigerator because I didn't want to waste a glass and ice. And so by Christmas of 1989, I feel terrible. Now, physically, I didn't feel so bad. But morally and spiritually, I was dead. I felt awful. So in the middle of the night, I uttered this prayer to God. And I said, God, you have got to get me out of this shit. So God, in his wisdom and with a little bit of humor, I ended up in treatment 2 months later. And I said, God, that was not what I meant. I said, you got me wrong. Actually, I didn't just end up in treatment because I actually tried to commit suicide. You know, I tried to cut myself. I was bleeding all over the place. Just a mess. And my ex-wife cleaned me up, took me to a hospital, and I finally told the truth. I think that was the first time I can ever remember really telling the truth. Doctor came in, he asked me, what's up? And I told him. I told him in great detail what I had been doing. So he said, we're going to get you some help. First, we're going to make sure you ain't going to die. So they did a bunch of studies. They determined I was not going to die. By that time, I'm feeling pretty good. And I said, hell, I wish I had died because this is really awful. So stay in the hospital for a day. They sent me to a place called CPC Parkwood. Any of you veterans of these environments, CPC Parkwood. So I end up over there. And that was actually the first time I met Paul early. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. A long time ago, but it seems like, you know, there are certain kinds of pennies that keep going around. I'm the bad penny. Trust me, I'm not calling Paul a bad penny. But so I had this doctor, and he tells me on the second afternoon, he said, tomorrow night I will be coming back in, and I'm going to give you the secret. So I'll tell you, I was so excited, I did not know what to do. Also, that same night I went to a meeting, picked up white chips, saw people getting blue chips. I said, I want me one of those. And I went to bed dreaming of blue chips. And because I said, you know, it can't be long before I get me one of those. Anyway, the next night, I wait all day for this guy. I'm thinking maybe he'll come in early since he's going to give me this wonderful news. Well, he comes in that evening, and I'll tell you one thing about it. Whenever doctors are going to give you really great news, they wait all day because they can charge you more. So anyway, he comes in. Here he rolls in, and he smiles, and he's all serene and everything, and he tells me, I am going to give you the secret. And I'm waiting. I said, man, this is going to be it. I know it is. And he said, you will not drink, and you will go to AA. Well, you know, I am really a nice guy superficially. So when people say things to me like that, I smile. But I'll tell you, I could have cut him. But but of course, they don't let you bring knives into places like that for good reason. So, you know, we go to an AA meeting, and that was the first time in my life I felt like I was ever at home. My very first time in my whole life. You know, when I'd get drunk, I felt better. When I went to AA, I was finally at home, and it was something mystical. And in many ways, that first AA meeting was a lot like that first drunk. You know, the first drunk, never felt so free in my life, never felt so warm, never so comfortable. First AA meeting, same thing. And it was a mystery to me, and to this day, I cannot explain it except for the presence of God. God has got to be in AA because nothing could ever make you feel so warm. I made one mistake through that process at Parkwood. I had to come back every night for a long time and stuff like that. And, you know, and I remember one night after a couple months, because they let me out of day treatment after a week. Man, I'm a whiz. Trust me. When I come into treatment, you know, I am a wonder. So anyway, you'll see I'm lying in just a few minutes. But anyway, I made one mistake. I was leaving that second part of treatment, whatever they call it, stuff where you just come for a little time rather than the whole time, you know, and they actually let you go home. And of course, I go back to work because I'm a worker. And, well, sort of. And anyway, as I was driving away from Parkwood, one night the thought comes to my mind, when I am 60 years old, I can retire, buy a desert island, and see, being familiar with the Air Force and all, C-131, a transport airplane for you folks who are kind of novices in this stuff. So, and load it with liquor and cocaine on pallets, airdrop onto my island. Now, you think I'm kidding, but that was my thought. It was a vision as clear as you all are sitting here, clearer. And so, you know, so have you ever heard the term, the idea must be thoroughly smashed? Well, guess who didn't smash the idea? Yours truly. I came back to Athens. I was told to get a sponsor, so I started having coffee with a guy occasionally. And I was told to work the steps, so I read them briefly and nodded my head in understanding. And I proceeded to start working with a guy who is today my sponsor. He had a little treatment center. I started doing some volunteer work. Suddenly, I was doing 12-step work. So I felt really good about myself. I could talk the talk. I could tell you all the kind of stuff in the book, everything you want to hear. So I will tell you this. In 1998, after starting to dabble in a few samples in the office, the doctors would sometimes get these narcotics and things, you know, and say, what the hell? Overdose. And as opposed to coming to a hospital in Atlanta by my choice, I am taken to a hospital in Athens, Georgia, where I am on the staff. And I arrive, and I am not awake. But shortly after, I wake up, and I look around, and there are people that I know. And they are very suspicious that I have had a drug overdose. So I'm just a tad embarrassed at that point. And they actually keep me in the hospital until the next day. And more people look at me very strangely. And about a month later, I get called to the chief of hospital services office, and he says, we need to have a conversation. And he says, you know, I think you might be, you think you might have a problem? And I said, who, me? He said, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to send you to Ridgeview for a 96-hour evaluation. Well, I'm going to tell you. Probably most of you have some idea of what that is, but if there's anybody in here who doesn't know what a 96-hour evaluation, anybody tells you that, run. Fast. Because I got over here for the euphemistic 96-hour evaluation, and a month later, I was going home. That's what I will tell you, a month later. And I was not too happy, but I had made a decision I was going to do as I was told. This time I was going to do as I was told. So you see, that's the what it was like, what happened, what it was like, what happened. Okay. The miracle really is what it's like now. Because starting in 1998, August 30th, 1998, which is my sobriety birthday, picked up a white chip right over here that Sunday night, and I said, you know, something's got to change. Something's got to change. God is going to stop co-signing my bullshit. You know, he really is. He already showed me he's got this sense of humor, so I had already gotten real careful about my prayers. But at that point, I decide, you know, I better keep it real simple because God listens to me literally, and he does exactly what I tell him to do. So I decided that maybe it would be better if I keep it simple, like wake up and say, God, this is Ferris, I'm an alcoholic, good morning. And I do, every morning, I do that, just in case overnight God forgets that I'm an alcoholic. Seriously, I'm not kidding. I don't expect God to remember me out of all of you folks. So, you know, just in case we're praying at the same time, I want him to know this is me and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what you are. But, and then I thank him for waking me up, for not letting me get up during the night and drink and use or any dope, because I used to do that too. And then I ask him to give me knowledge of his will for me today, and the power to carry it out. Because what I used to want was knowledge of his will for me for the rest of my life and all the power I could use from now on. And it turns out I cannot handle that because I don't know what God's will is for me tomorrow. You know, God's will for me tomorrow may be that my leg falls off. I don't want to know that. You know, I just need it for today, and that's all I can handle. But I'll tell you what. I decided I was going to work the steps, but I wasn't really sure, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do for a sponsor, but I was told I needed a sponsor. So I started talking to this guy that I had known for many years. His name is Roki Fajardo, and Roki is 92 years old at this point, and he's been sober for 40-something years. And he's presently in hospice right over near Turner Field. He is still awake, alert, oriented, and can talk your head off. But we got together, and we started seriously working the steps. One at a time. And I started to realize the steps are very complicated and intricate. You know, each step has got probably at least two parts, if not more. And that was a miracle. I said, what? And I read the big book slowly, two pages at a time. See, I'm usually kind of a speed reader, but not a speed comprehender. So, you know, and I figured this was something maybe I needed to comprehend. So I started reading the big book two pages at a time, and it takes a nice long time, which is good for me because I don't need to get through with anything too fast. And after I read the big book, then I read the 12 and 12, two pages at a time. And, you know, I have done that repeatedly over the years. And then, for some strange reason, one day Roki says to me, I am so happy you asked me to be your sponsor. And I thought to myself, what? But, you know, being the nice guy, oh, yeah, right. And so he's been my sponsor for 14 years now. And he's the greatest guy in the world because he does not co-sign my bullshit. He really doesn't. And he hurts my feelings sometimes because I'll tell him something and he'll say, no, do this. And I'll say, but Roki, that's not going to work. And he'll say, try it. And I try it and it works. And I don't go back and tell him it works because then he might tell me I told you so. But, you know, he's the kind of guy who can look in my face and tell me when there's something wrong. You know, he'll look in my face and he'll say, what's wrong? And I'll say, nothing. And he'll say, yes, it is. And I'll say, no, it's not. And he'll say, yes, it is. And I may think it's very insignificant, but I tell him what it is. And he will ask me one question, and I'm so tired of him asking me that, I ought to know this one already, but he'll say, have you prayed about it yet? And it's like, oh, I forgot. You know, he's just the greatest guy in the world. But not only that, I have actually managed to surround myself with a community of people who can look at me and they'll say, what's wrong? And it's my responsibility to pause and consider what the question really is. Because usually they have seen something that I haven't. Because what I figured out is I don't really know me very well. I don't know me very well. Well, I was sober for about 2 years, year and a half, 2 years, something like that. So one night, it was an interesting night, actually. I was on what was called service call, which means if somebody comes in town, they ain't got a doctor, they need to be admitted, they call you. So I get a call about 9 o'clock, from one hospital. Two crack addicts, man and a woman, have been in a fight, and they need to be admitted to the hospital because they're just wired out on crack. Well, I get over there, and I can tell that these folks are wired out and probably no hope. And actually, I was right. But I admit them to the hospital anyway. So I go back home, and I go to bed. And about midnight, I get a call from the other hospital. And the doctor in the ER says, we got this guy over here, and we don't really know exactly what's wrong with him, but he's kind of out of it, and we just aren't sure. So I said, well, okay. Now, trust me, for me to get out of bed after midnight to go to the hospital to see somebody, it doesn't take an act of Congress. It takes an act of God. And so I got out of bed, went over to the hospital, and who... Who would I see but George Mize? Laying on the hospital bed with his eyes open, looking at him. I said, what the hell? I go in and I talk to him. He said, huh? He was comical. I wish you could see the movie. So we find out, you know, George is being transported by his lovely mother, Marie, you know, loving, tender, kind, considerate, you know. She's taking her little baby boy, George, from Augusta, where they have worked him up for this unknown liver disease. He's got some strange liver disease. Don't nobody know nothing. You know, Augusta now. So that tells you something else. Do not go to the hospital in Augusta. But anyway, so he's being transported from Augusta to Emory, where he's going to be on the transplant list because George needs a new liver. So I look at his lab work and his blood alcohol is 300. I say, he's drunk. I said, this fool has alcoholic liver disease. I said, hell. So anyway, so the ER doctor looked at me like I'm some wizard. And I go in and I talk to George. I said, you're drunk. He said, huh? So I go out and they say, well, the mother wants to talk to you. Well, I'm going to tell you, by the time you get into 1 o'clock in the morning, you don't want to talk to nobody, and especially somebody's mama. But I'm a nice guy. So I go around and there she is, sweet little Marie, sitting in the room worried about her little baby George. And I said, ma'am, he's drunk. She said, but he couldn't be, because I picked him up from home and he wasn't drunk, and he's only been in the car with me. I said, he's drunk, ma'am. So, you know, I kind of figured what he had done, but I didn't want to go into all that night. But you know what? This is God at work. George's grandmother and my grandmother were in the same nursing home, and George's mother and my mother had developed a relationship. And so somehow or the other, my mother, you know, she's proud of her doctor, was. My mother died in 1999, but she was proud of her doctor's son. So people generally got the idea that her son was a doctor some way or the other. So, and she was very proud of me. She didn't bother telling me he's an alcoholic and a drug addict, because she really didn't know all that much. But anyway, so George's mother sort of believed me because I had preset credibility. Now I'm going to tell you, if that ain't God at work, I don't know what is. For all of that stuff to happen, for that convergence, because I want to tell you this, were it not for this man, there are a lot of folks who would be dead today. I can tell you that for a fact. I have helped some. George has helped many. And I want to tell you, to see somebody who's laying there, you know, huh, and his liver going south, he gets sober, his liver gets well, he wakes up, but that's not the end of the story. I put him in the hospital, blood alcohol 300, so I call over here to Ridgeview. I talk to Mike Fishman. I say, Mike, you know, I got somebody I need to send you. This guy really needs to get over there. He really needs help. He said, well, is he stable, Ferris? Oh, yeah, Mike, he is stable. He's just rock solid. He's got a 300 at midnight, so he's rock solid. Nothing's going to happen. Well, George gets over here, walks through the door of Cottage C, and starts flopping like a fish. So Mike Fishman, you know, I was a team physician for a football team, and it's raining like hell on Friday night. And Mike Fishman pages me even though I'm not on call, because they page me any damn way. And Mike Fishman says, Ferris. After I go inside, because it's raining, I don't want to take my nice cell phone out in the rain, you know. So anyway, he says, Ferris, I thought you said he was stable. I said, yeah, Mike, he was stable. He said, well, he walked through the door and fell on the floor and started flopping like a fish. I said, really? He said, yeah, we had to send him next door. And I was scared shitless. I saw my malpractice insurance and my medical license. I just saw it leaving. I said, well, so what? Well, it's been a good run. Well, and Mike says, well, I'll call you back and let you know. And, you know, he promptly did not call me back. And I find out about a week later that George is back over here. He's doing all right. He did not die after all. I didn't kill the boy. You know, hopefully he doesn't remember who actually sent him over here. Because, you know, malpractice is hard to come by. And he ultimately, all of it came back and some. Now, see, I did not know George before he got sober. So I cannot tell you what he was like then. But I can tell you that whatever he was like, he ain't like that now. George helps more people than I've ever seen. He really does. He goes to the prison. I will not go into jail. I will not go into prison because I think they might forget who's supposed to leave. I do not do that. That's just my motto. If I go into jail, it's because I have been arrested. Or maybe one of my kids. I don't know. I might do it for one of the kids. But I'll tell you, this guy goes everywhere, he does everything, and so I feel like he is carrying my message. Alcoholics Anonymous, recovery, it's an amazing thing. I went on a cruise last week. My wife took me on a cruise to celebrate my birthday. She paid for most of it. And I went to a meeting on the ship. I've been to meetings across the country, just where I show up and I find a meeting. You know, I get online, find a meeting. And invariably, I walk into a room and I'm scared shitless. And then I get to know some people. And before I leave, I have a whole new set of friends. I really do. I have places to go. I have places to look forward to. I have experiences to look forward to. I have new things to look forward to. You know, it's like having this express card that lets you into a resort everywhere you go. It really is. And it's better than any resort because I don't have to worry about bed bugs, for one thing. And also, I don't have to worry about getting drunk because I have determined that you all do not serve booze at any meetings. So, you know, and you only charge me a buck. So, I mean, who can beat that? Who can beat that? A home away from home where people love you. Because I'm going to tell you, you know, I have a hard time with love. I really do. And it's because my love receptor is defective. It really is. You know, people tell me they love me, and then sometimes I kind of wonder, well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. Maybe I don't deserve to be loved. But it happens often enough that I stop thinking about me. I really do. I have to stop thinking about me. It's really not about me. It's not about me. It's about something far bigger than me. You know, my journey through Alcoholics Anonymous, through recovery, my journey through addiction and alcoholism, and my practice of medicine has brought me closer to God than I ever thought I would be. You know, I don't really have much power. I don't, but there is one who has all power, and I access him often, or her. I don't really care. I don't care if God has a gender. I don't care if God is an amoeba. I don't care, because whatever God is, God has so much power, and God's will is so powerful, and God is all for good. You know, God means me no harm, none whatsoever. I'm pretty convinced that if I am hell-bent on dying, God will ultimately simply step out of the way. I mean, if that's just really what I want to do, God will step out of the way. But as long as I am trying to do his will, as long as I am submissive to God's will, God just takes care of me, wraps his arms around me, and he just carries me. You know, my father is in assisted living. He had a .38 pistol. And they kept it in his headboard. So I go over to his house, and I get his .38. And I said, you know, I think I'll start carrying that .38 in the truck. So I take the .38 home, put it in my headboard, and that's where it is today. I don't need to carry a gun. Number one, I'm probably going to shoot myself before I shoot anybody else. And frankly, why would I want to kill somebody? I mean, I just don't want to do that because I don't have that. That's not my job to kill anybody. I cannot give life. I could have killed a lot of people because my job, it's real easy for me to kill somebody. It's incredibly easy for me to kill somebody. Drinking and driving, it's incredibly easy. I have driven with my little kids in the car. I had two boys. I would strap them into them flimsy car seats of the 1980s and drive up and down the road drunk and heard people talking about me on CB radio. And yet, my boys are 30 and 28. They are not alcoholics. They're not drug addicts. My little baby girl is 25. She's not a drug addict or an alcoholic. I don't have anything to do with that because I can tell you this. I would feel incredibly guilty if they were. But God does not want me to feel that kind of guilt, I reckon. So for today, they're to stay just don't drink. I mean, they drink a little bit. I know my son in California, he's 28. He's in L.A. He's got to drink a little bit. But, you know, I don't worry about it because I started drinking when I was 13 years old. And I didn't start sipping when I was 13 years old. I didn't have a cocktail or a highball. I was not a social drinker when I was 13. When I used heroin, I was not a social heroin user. When I took narcotics, I was not a social narcotics user. When I smoked dope, I was not a social. I didn't just, you know, stick my pinky out and hold the joint. I didn't do that. You know, I went all the way. And yet God did not drop me off. Because God looked over the horizon of time and he said, you know, I think I want you to do something. I don't know what, and I'm not going to tell you. But you'll find out if you stick around. And, you know, to this day, he's let me stick around. He's let me see so many wonderful things. And, you know, it doesn't cost any money. It's very inexpensive, but it's priceless. It is priceless. I love you guys. I love this place. I love you, George. Thank you.
When I left Ridgeview, I went to Athens, and I lived with my mother because nobody else would have me, and I went through the commencement center there, and who should I meet? But again, it was some guy who said he knew me before I was at Ridgeview, and of course I didn't believe him, but he knew this story so well, you know, that he, you know, I thought, how could he make up something like that, you know? And it was true, and so Ferris is still in practice. If you're in Athens, if you're in Athens and you need some treatment, you know what I mean? You can see him. He's come a long way, and I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy. I've been trying to get him to come here for years, but like he said, he was with the football team.